The Hermit by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 9. The day was wearing on, dragging weary hour after weary hour. The young monk gazed, as he had gazed most of the day, up to the notch in the mountain range wherein was sheltered the pass between India and Tibet. Suddenly he uttered a whoop of joy and turned on his heels before dashing into the cave. "Venerable one," he cried, "they are starting down the path. Soon we shall have food." Not waiting for an answer, he spun around and rushed out into the open. In the clear, cold air of Tibet, minute details can be seen over long distances. There is no air pollution to mask one's sight. Over the rocky ridge came pouring black dots. The young man smiled with satisfaction. Food. Soon there would be barley and tea. Quickly he dashed down to the edge of the lake and filled the water can so that it was even slopping over. Carefully and slowly he carried it back to the cave so that the water would be available when the food was. Down the slope he hurried again that he might gather the last of the branches from the storm-blasted tree. A considerable pile of firewood was now stacked beside the glowing fire. Impatiently, the young man climbed up the rock face above the cave. Shielding his eyes from the glare, he stared out and upwards. A long line of animals moved away from the lake. Horses, not yaks. Indians, not Tibetans. Numbly, the young man stood there dwelling upon that awful thing. Slowly, heavily, he descended to the ground level and re-entered the cave. "Venerable one," he said sadly, "the men are Indians. They're not coming our way, and we have no food." "Worry not," said the old hermit soothingly, "for an empty stomach makes a clear brain. We shall manage. We must have patience." A sudden thought struck the younger man. Grasping the water can, he hurried to the rock where all the barley had been spilled. Carefully he sank to his knees and scrabbled in the sandy soil. Here was barley and sand. "Sand will sink in water," he thought, "while barley will float." Carefully he dropped handful after handful of soil in the water can and tapped the side. The sand sank and the barley floated. Little lumps of tea brick floated too. Time after time he scooped the barley and tea lumps from the surface of the water and placed them in his bowl. Soon he had to obtain the old hermit's bowl, and at last, when the evening shadows were again creeping across the countryside, both bowls were full. Tiredly, the young monk rose to his feet, hefted the sand-filled water can, and left the cave. Outside, he lost no time in tipping out the useless contents of the can. Then, gloomily, he made his way down the path to the lake. Night birds were coming awake, and the full moon was peeping over the mountain edge as he scoured the can and filled it with water. Warily he washed his knees free of embedded sand and barley grains before lifting the can again and wending his way back to the cave. With a thump of resignation, he dropped the can into the heart of the fire and sat by the flames while impatiently waiting for the water to boil. At last, the first wisps of steam arose and mingled with the smoke of the fire. The young monk rose too and fetched the two bowls with the barley and tea and quite a bit of earth mixture. Carefully he dumped the whole lot into the water. Soon the steam was rising again. Soon after, the water was bubbling energetically, stirring up the brown mess. With a flat piece of bark, the young man scooped off the worst of the floating debris. Unable to wait longer, he hooked a stick under the handle of the can and lifted it from the fire. First, he dipped the old hermit's bowl in the can and scooped out a generous helping of the porridge contents. Wiping his fingers on his already grubby robe, he hurried into the old man with the unexpected and rather unsavory supper. Then he returned for his own food. It was eatable, just. With the pangs of hunger but barely assuaged, they lay down upon the hard and cheerless sandy soil for yet another night of sleep. Beyond the cave, the moon rose high and sailed in majestic decline beyond the far mountain range. Creatures of the night went about their lawful occasion, and the night wind rustled gently through the gaunt branches of the stunted trees. In far lamasaries, the night proctors pursued their ceaseless vigil, while in the back streets of the city, those of ill repute sat and plotted how they might secure the advantage over their more trusting fellows. The morning was cheerless. The remnants of the sodden barley and tea leaves made but poor fare, but as the sole means of sustenance available, it just had to be forced down. With the morning light growing and the newly fed fire sending out sputtering showers of sparks from surface-dried wood, the old hermit said, "Let us continue the passing of knowledge. It may help us to forget our hunger." Together, the old man and the young entered the cave and sat in their accustomed positions. "I drifted a while," said the hermit, "like the thought of an idle man, without direction and without purpose, vacillating, flitting from screen to screen as the fancy took me. Then the voice intruded upon me, saying, 'We must tell you more.' As the voice spoke, I found that I was being turned and directed to the screens which I had first studied. Now, again, they were active. Upon one screen was depicted the universe containing what we now know to be the solar system." The voice resumed. "For centuries, most careful watch was kept in case there should be any radiation hazard from the new system now in formation. Millions of years went by, but in the life of a universe, a million years is as minutes in the lifetime of a human. At last, another expedition set out from this, the heart of our empire. An expedition equipped with the most modern apparatus with which to determine the planning of new worlds which we should seed." The voice ceased, and I looked again at the screens. The stars glittered cold and remote in the stupendous distances of space. Hard and brittle, they shone with more colors than that of the rainbow. The picture grew larger and larger until a world was shown which seemed to be just a ball of cloud. Turbulent clouds slashed through and through with the most fearsome lightning. 'It is not possible,' said the voice, 'to make a true analysis of a distant world by remote probes. At one time we believed otherwise, but experience has taught us our error. Now, for millions of years, we have sent expeditions. Look. The universe was swept aside as one draws aside a curtain. Again I saw a plane stretching out to what seemed to be infinity. The buildings were different. Now they were long and low. The great vessel which stood there ready was different too. Something like two platters was this vessel, the lower half a platter standing as a platter should stand, while the upper rested upon the lower, but inverted. It shone bright, even as the full moon. Hundreds of round holes with glass behind them encircled the circumference. Upon the utmost elevation there rested a dome-shaped, transparent room, possibly some 50 feet across. The gigantic girth of the vessel entirely dwarfed the toiling machines which labored at its base to supply it. In groups there loitered men and women, all in strange uniform dress, all with a number of boxes reposing at their feet upon the ground. The talk seemed to be merry, the humor good. More ornately attired individuals strutted unapproachably backwards and forwards as though deliberating upon the fate of a world, as indeed they may have been. A sudden signal made them all bend quickly, seize their packages, and scurry to the waiting vessel. Metallic doors, like the iris of an eye, closed tightly behind them. Slowly, the immense metal creation rose some 100 feet into the air. It hovered for a moment of time and then just vanished, leaving no trail of any kind to mark that it had ever existed. The voice said, "It travels at a speed unthinkably faster than the speed of light. It is a self-contained world, and when one is in these ships, one is quite unaffected by any outside influences. There is no sensation of speed, no feeling of falling, not even on the sharpest turns. Space," continued the voice, "is not the empty void that your own worldlians believe. Space is an area of reduced density. There is an atmosphere of hydrogen molecules. The separate molecules may be hundreds of miles apart, admittedly, but at the speed generated by our vessels, that atmosphere seems almost as dense as the sea. One hears the molecules rushing against the side of the ship, and we had to take special measures to overcome the problem of heating through molecular friction. But look." On an adjacent screen, the disc-shaped vessel was tearing along, leaving an almost intangible trail of faint blue light behind it. The speed was so great that as the picture moved to keep the ship centered, the stars appeared as solid lines of light. The voice murmured, "We will omit the needless travel sequences and keep to the items which matter. Look at the other screen." I did so, and witnessed the vessel, now traveling very much more slowly, circling around the sun, our sun. But a sun very, very different from what it is now. It was larger, brighter, and vast streamers of flame reached out far beyond its girth. The ship circled round, orbiting first one world and then another. At last it drew close to the world which somehow I know to be the Earth. Completely enshrouded in clouds, it rolled beneath the ship. Several orbits were made, and then the vessel slowed even more. The picture changed, and I was shown inside. A small group of men and women were walking down a long metal corridor. At the end, they debouched into an enclosure, wherein there were small replicas of the large vessel. Men and women walked up a ramp and entered one of these smaller ships. All other people left that area. Behind a transparent wall, a man watched, his eyes upon strange colored buttons with flashing lights before him. A light glowed green, and the man pressed several buttons simultaneously. A section of the floor retreated equally from the small ship and opened as the iris of an eye opens. The ship fell through and entered space. Lower and lower it glided until it was lost to our view in the clouds which encompassed the earth. Then the picture before me changed again, and I saw, as from the small craft itself, here were the swirling, billowing clouds, appearing first as impenetrable barriers, but melting away at the touch of the spaceship. Down, down we went, through miles of cloud, until at last we merged it to a dull, sullen day. Gray sea rolled and surged, and in the distance seemed to merge with the gray clouds, clouds upon which were reflected ruddy glares from some unknown source. The spaceship leveled off and flew between cloud and sea. The miles passed, miles of endless surging sea. Upon the skyline, a dark mass appeared, a dark mass shot through by intermittent gouts of flame. The ship moved on. Soon below us, there loomed a great mass of mountainous land. Vast volcanoes reared their ugly heads high towards the clouds. Tremendous flames shot forth, and molten lava came tumbling down the mountainsides to plunge into the sea with a hissing roar. Although it had been a gray blur in the distance, close to the land appeared as a very dull red. The ship moved on and circumnavigated the world for a number of times. There was but one immense landmass surrounded by the tossing sea, which, from the lower altitude, seemed to be steaming. At last, it rose, entered space, and returned to the parent ship. The screen faded as the vessel sped again back to the Empire world. The voice, now so accustomed to speaking in my brain, commented, "No, I am not merely speaking to you, I am also addressing those who are participating in this experience. Because you are so receptive, you are aware of all my remarks by what we term acoustic feedback. But pay attention, this applies to you also." The second expedition returned to, here there was a name, but it is beyond my power to pronounce it, so I will transpose and say, "Our Empire." Scientists studied the reports submitted by the crews. Assessments were made of the probable number of centuries before the world was fit for stocking with living creatures. Biologists and geneticists worked together to formulate plans for the best type of creatures to be made. When a new world is to be stocked, and when that world is the offspring of a nova, ponderous animals and heavy foliage is first required. All soil consists of powdered rock, with lava dust and certain trace elements. Such soil will support only coarse feeding plants. Then those plants decay, and the animals die and decay and mix with the rock dust. In the course of millenniums, soil is formed. As the soil becomes more and more remote from the original rock, finer types of plants can be grown. In time, on any planet, the soil is really the cells of decayed animals and plants and the excreta of the former for eons past. I had the impression that the owner of the voice paused while he surveyed his audience. Then he continued. The atmosphere of a new planet is not at all breathable by humans. The effluvia from the belching volcanoes contains sulfur and many noxious and lethal gases. Suitable vegetation will overcome this by absorbing the toxins and returning them as harmless minerals to the soil. The vegetation will take the poisonous fumes and convert them to the oxygen and nitrogen which humanoids require. So the scientists of many branches work together for centuries preparing the basic stock. These were then placed upon a nearby world of similar conditions so that they could mature, so that we could ensure that they were entirely satisfactory. If necessary, they could then be modified. So, for ages, the new planetary system was left to its own devices, left while wind and waves eroded the sharp rock pinnacles. For millions of years, tempests beat upon that rocky land. Powdered rock spilled forth from high peaks. Heavy stones fell and rolled under the storms, grinding the rock powder ever finer. The giant waves beat in fury on the land, breaking off spurs, bumping them together, reducing them to smaller and smaller particles. The lava that flowed white-hot into the waters fumed and foamed and split into millions of particles to become the sand of the sea. The waves flung the sand back on the land, and the continual scouring wore down the mountains from their mile-high altitude to merely tens of thousands of feet. Endless centuries of earth time passed. The blazing sun blazed not so fiercely. No longer did flaming gobbets become spewed out to engulf and incinerate adjacent objects. Now the sun burned fairly regularly. The nearby worlds, too, cooled. Their orbits steadied. Every so often, little lumps of rocks collided with other masses, and the whole plunged into the sun, making a temporary increase in its flaming intensity. But the system was steadying down. The world, called Earth, was becoming ready to receive its first life. At the Empire base, a vast ship was being prepared to travel to the Earth, and the members of what would be the third expedition were being trained in all matters relating to their coming task. Men and women were being selected for compatibility and for the absence of neurosis. Each spaceship is a self-contained world in which the air is manufactured by plants and water is obtained from excess air and hydrogen, the cheapest things in the whole universe. Instruments were loaded, general supplies, the new stock were carefully frozen, ready to be reanimated at the appointed time. At long last, for there was no hurry, the third expedition was ready. I watched the vessel slide through the Empire universe, cross yet another, and enter that which contained at its distant edge the new Earth. There were many, many worlds circling around the bright sun. These were ignored. All attention was given to the one planet. The great vessel decelerated and swung in an orbit such that it was stationary relative to one point on the Earth. Aboard the ship, a small craft was made ready. Six men and women entered, and again an opening appeared in the floor of the parent ship, through which the survey vessel dropped. Again, on the screen, I watched as it fell through the thick cloud and emerged a few thousand feet above the water. Moving in a horizontal plane, it soon came to where the rock land projected above the water. The volcanic eruptions, although most violent, were yet less intense than previously. The shower of rock debris was less profuse. Carefully, very, very carefully, the small ship sank lower and lower. Keen eyes searched the surface for the most suitable landing place, and at last, with that location decided upon, it made landfall. Here, resting upon the hard surface, the crew made what appeared to be routine tests. Satisfied, four members of the crew donned strange garments which covered them from neck to feet. Upon their head, each person placed a round, transparent globe which connected in some way with the neckpiece of the garment already donned. Each picked up a case and entered a small room, the door of which was carefully closed and fastened behind them. A light opposite another door glowed red. The black pointer on a circular dial commenced to move, and as it came to rest over an O, the red light turned to green, and the outer door swung open. A strange metal ladder, as though imbued with life of its own, rattled across the floor and extended down to the ground some 15 feet below. One man carefully descended the ladder and stamped about as he reached the surface. From the case he drew a long rod, which he thrust into the ground. Bending, he minutely examined the markings upon the surface of that rod, and, rising to his feet, beckoned to the others that they should join him. The little party moved around, seemingly at random, doing things which had no meaning for me. Save that I knew these to be intelligent adults, I would have put down their antics to that of children playing games. Some picked up little stones and put them in a bag. Some hit the ground with hammers or stuck in what appeared to be metal rods. Yet another, a female I observed, wandered around waving little strips of sticky glass and then hastily inserted them in bottles. All these things were quite incomprehensible to me. At last, they returned to their vessel and entered the first compartment. They stood still, like cattle in a marketplace, while remarkable colored lights shone and moved over the entire surface of each. A light glowed green, and the other colored lights were extinguished. The party removed their protective garments and entered the main body of the ship. Soon, there was a great to-do. The female with the sticky glass strips rushed to put each one in a metallic device. Putting her face to it so that she could look through two tubes, She turned knobs, making comments to others the while. The man with the little pebbles tipped them into a machine, which emitted a great whir and suddenly ejected the pebbles, which were now reduced to a fine powder. Many tests were made. Many conversations were held with the great parent ship. Other of these vessels appeared, and while the first one withdrew and returned to the greater vessel, those which remained circled the whole of the world, and from there they dropped articles which fell onto the land, and others of a different type fell into the sea. Satisfied with their work, all the small craft drew close and formed a line, after which they rose up and left the atmosphere of the earth. One by one, each re-entered the mother ship, and when the last had done so, the great vessel sped from that orbit and traveled to other worlds in that system. Thus it was that many, many years of earth time was occupied. Many centuries passed on the earth. In the time of a ship traveling through space, it was but weeks, for the two times are different in some manner, difficult to comprehend, but it is so. Many centuries passed, and rough, coarse vegetation flourished on the land and under the waters. Vast ferns towered skywards with immense thick leaves, absorbing the poisonous gases and breathing out oxygen by day and nitrogen by night. At long last, an arc of space descended through the clouds and landed upon a sandy shore. Great hatches were opened, and from out of the mile-long vessel, lumbering nightmare creatures came, so ponderous that the earth shook to their tread. Horrendous creatures flapped heavily into the air on creaking leather wings. The great ark, the first of many to come throughout the ages, rose into the air and glided gently over the seas. At predetermined areas, the ark rested upon the surface of the water, and strange creatures flopped into the ocean depths. The immense vessel rose and vanished into the remotest recesses of space. Upon the earth, incredible creatures lived and fought, bred and died. The atmosphere changed. The foliage changed, and the creatures evolved. The eons passed, and from the observatory of the wise ones, universes distant, watch was kept. The earth was wobbling in its orbit. A dangerous degree of eccentricity was developing. From the heart of the empire there came a special ship. The scientists decided that one land mass was insufficient to prevent the seas from surging and unbalancing the world. From the great vessel hovering miles above the surface, a thin beam of light shot out. The exposed continent of the earth shivered and cracked apart into smaller masses. Violent earthquakes took place, and in the fullness of time, the land masses drifted apart, forming ramparts against which the sea, now divided into seas, beat in vain. The earth settled into stable orbit. Millions of years crawled by. Millions of years of earth time. Again an expedition approached from the empire. This time it brought the first humanoids to the world. Strange purple creatures were unloaded, the women having 8 breasts, the men and women having a head set square on the shoulders, so that to see at the side the whole body had to be turned. The legs were short, and the arms were long, descending to below the knees. They knew nothing of fire or weapons, and yet they were ever a quarrel. They lived in caves and in the branches of mighty trees. For food, they had berries and grasses and the insects which crawled the earth. But the watchers were not satisfied, for these were but mindless creatures who could not fend for themselves and who showed no signs of evolving. By now, vessels of that empire were on constant patrol through the universe which held the solar system. Other worlds here, too, were being developed. That of another planet was proceeding much more quickly than the Earth. A ship of the patrol was detached to go to the Earth where it landed. A few of the purple natives were captured and examined, and it was decided that the whole race should be exterminated, just as a gardener exterminates weeds. A pestilence fell upon the earth, and all the humanoids were killed. The voice broke in, saying, "In years to come, your own earth people will use this system to kill off a plague of rabbits, but your people will use a pestilence which will kill the rabbits in agony. We do it painlessly." From the skies there came another ark, bringing different animals and very different humanoids. Throughout the lands they were distributed, a different type and perhaps a different color chosen to suit the conditions of that area. The earth still roared and rumbled. Volcanoes belched forth flames and fumes, and the molten lava came pouring down the mountain sides. The seas were cooling, and the life therein was changing to meet the altering conditions. At the two poles, the waters were cold, and the first ice on earth was beginning to form. The ages went by. The atmosphere of Earth changed. Giant fern-like growths gave way to orthodox trees. Life forms became stabilized. A mighty civilization flourished. Around the world flew the gardeners of the Earth, visiting city after city, but some of them became too familiar with their human charges, or the women thereof. An evil priest of the human race persuaded a beautiful woman to seduce one of the gardeners and to inveigle him so that he betrayed forbidden secrets. Soon, the woman was in possession of certain weapons formerly in the man's care. Within the hour, the priest had them. By treachery, certain of the priestly caste manufactured atomic weapons, using the stolen one as a pattern. A plot was hatched whereby certain of the gardeners were invited to a temple for celebrations and thanksgiving. Here, in the sacred grounds, the gardeners were poisoned. Their equipment was stolen. A great assault was made on the other gardeners. In the battle, the atomic pile of a grounded spacecraft was exploded by a priest. The whole world shook. The great continent of Atlantis sank beneath the waves. In far-off lands, tornadoes rent the mountains and tore humans apart. Great waves stormed in from the seas, and the world became almost barren of human life. Barren, save for a few who cowered, whimpering with terror in remote caves. For years, the earth shook and shivered with the effects of the atomic blast. For years, no gardener came to inspect the world. Radiation was strong, and the scared remnants of humanity brought forth mutated progeny. Plant life was affected, and the atmosphere became debased. The sun was obscured by lowering red clouds. At long last, the wise ones decreed that yet another expedition should travel to Earth and take new stock to their desecrated garden. The great ark of humans, animals, and plants set forth through the far reaches of space. The old hermit fell over with a gasp. The young monk leaped in the air with the shock and then hurried over to the fallen ancient. The little bottle of precious drops was at hand, and soon the old man was lying on his side, breathing normally. "You need food, venerable one," exclaimed the younger man. "I will place water beside you, and then I will climb to the solemn contemplation hermitage to obtain tea and barley. I will hurry." The hermit nodded weakly and relaxed as the young monk placed a bowl of water beside him and put the full water can within easy reach. "I will go by way of the cliff side," he said as he hurried out of the cave. Along the mountain foot he ran, gazing upwards for signs of the faint trail which led to the wider path far above. Here, 2,000 feet higher and 6 miles away, there was the hermitage wherein many dwelt. Food would be available for the asking, but the way was hard and the daylight even now was beginning to fail. Grimly the young monk lengthened his stride. Acutely he stared at the rock face until at last he discerned the faint marks where once before he had climbed the mountain face. By the twisted, scrubby bush, he turned sharp right and immediately encountered the cruel, knife-like stones which discouraged so many others and led them to take a path which increased the 6 miles to more than 20, so devious was the way. Slowly he struggled upwards, seeking handholds where none seemed possible. Foot by foot he ascended. The sun sank below the far mountain range, and he rested a while, sitting astride a boulder. Soon the first silver rays of the rising moon peeped over the mountain range. Soon the cliff face above was illumined sufficiently to make further travel possible. Clawing and digging in fingers and toes, he inched his way perilously upwards. Below him, the valley was in deep shadow. With a gasp of relief, he reached up and tumbled onto the narrow track leading to the hermitage. Half running, breathing, coming in sobs, and aching in every limb, he made his way the remaining miles. Feebly gleaming in the distance, the flickering butter lamp shone as a beacon of hope to the benighted traveler. Gasping for breath and faint with the need for food, the young man stumbled the last few yards to the hermitage door. From inside came the mumbling chant of an aged man, clearly praying entirely by rote. "Here is no religious devotee whom I might disturb," thought the young monk as he called out loudly. "Caretaker of hermits, I am in need." The low, reiterated mumbling ceased. There was the creak of aged bones moving more quickly, and then the door slowly opened. Blackly outlined against a solitary butter lamp, which flared and sputtered in the sudden draught, the old priest caretaker, with high, raised voice, demanded, "Who is there? Who are you that calls at this hour of the night?" Slowly, the young monk moved so that he could be seen. The caretaker relaxed at the sight of the red robe. "Come, enter," he bade. The young man stepped hesitantly forward. Reaction set in, and he was tired. "Fellow priest," he said, "the venerable hermit with whom I am staying is ill, and we have no food. We've had none today nor yesterday. No trader has come to us. We have only the lake water. Can you give us food?" The priest caretaker clucked with sympathy. "Food? Yes, of a surety I could give you food. Barley, already well ground. A brick of tea? Butter, sugar, yes. But you must rest tonight. You cannot traverse the mountain path tonight." "I must, fellow priest," exclaimed the young monk. "The venerable one starves. The Buddha will protect me."
"Then stay a while and eat a little and drink tea. It is all ready. Eat and drink, and I will pack a shoulder bag for you. I have plenty."
So it was that the young man sat in the lotus position and gave prostrations in thanks for the welcome so sincerely given. He sat and ate sampa and drank strong tea, while the old caretaker babbled all the gossip and news which the well-served hermitage had heard. The inmost one was a travel. The great Lord Abbot of Drepung had made disparaging remarks about another. The College of Proctors were giving thanks to a guardian cat who had located a persistent thief among certain traders. A Chinese had been waylaid on a mountain pass and, in trying to escape, so it was said, had slipped over the edge to fall some 2,000 feet. The body was all broken up and ready for the vultures without any further human aid. But time was not standing still. At last, reluctantly, the young monk stood and took the proffered bag. With words of thanks and farewell, he strode out of the hermitage and made his cautious way down the path. The moon was now high. The light was silvery and brilliant. The path was clear, but the shadows were of the intense blackness known only to those who dwell in high places. Soon he came to the edge where he must leave the more secure way and clamber down the precipice. Slowly, cautiously, he lowered himself over the edge. With infinite care, somewhat handicapped by the weight on his shoulders, he crept downwards inch by inch, foot by foot, carefully holding with his hands while he felt for a secure hold with his feet, transferring his weight from his hands to his feet, from his feet to his hands. At last, with the moon declining overhead, he reached the darkened floor of the valley. Feeling his way from rock to rock, he progressed slowly until, before him, he saw the red glow of the fire before the cave entrance. Stopping only to put a few more branches on the fire, he tottered inside and sank down at the feet of the old hermit, whom he could just see by the light of the fire reflecting into the cave entrance. End of chapter 9.